Welcome to Leaders in Conversation, a series of podcasts in which leaders share their inspirational personal leadership stories with me, Annie Townend. In this episode, I'm delighted to be in conversation with Tor Lawrence. Welcome, Tor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I've known you for many years and through all that time, know you to be a passionate campaigner for nature, a mother and a writer, and now as Chief Executive for Sussex Wildlife Trust. You were brought up here in Sussex, a county in southeast England, and I would love to know, how has the countryside and the seaside shaped and influenced who you've become as a leader?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So I was brought up in Lewes, in what was my grandmother's house. And the county, I feel enormously proud to be Chief Exec of the Wildlife Trust in this county. It's such a beautiful place. And Lewes is obviously nestled in the Downs with the ooze and the tides and the sea. And that feels part of my DNA, really, the chalk and the water. I lived in the Weald for a little bit in the last decade and really missed the Downs. So I really know it to be part of the fabric of who I am. I'm not someone who grew up with a big connection to nature. Part of my understanding and learning about nature comes from the fact that I wasn't the child who played and explored in nature. I don't have many memories of nature. I have a different perspective, if you like, as a leader. I'm not someone with an ecology background or a conservation background. I'm someone who's learnt how a deficit of nature can shape someone as well, and how crucial it is later on in life to find that connection, and how supportive it can be for us. So I don't have a traditional story, if you like, of looking back and remembering birds and flowers and trees when I was little. I have that from my 20s.
And what was it that had you discover nature and that it could be a source of connection and nurturing for you, Tor?
So, to be honest, I think it was pinpointed to what I would call a breakdown in my early 20s, when I was really at edge of everything. And I went for a walk. I lived in Sheffield at the time, and I went for a walk in the Encliffe Park, Linear Park, which is a brook that runs through from the town centre of Sheffield out to the countryside. So it's a river valley with a series of linear parks that connect it. And I remember vividly walking along there and just not being attached, connected to anything, and just stopping and looking and having this, I guess, epiphany, looking at this tiny, tiny yellow flower that was exquisite and seemed to be a kind of wake-up call, I would guess, in retrospect. And I think it was a common rock rose. But what it did was it catapulted me into a better place. It catapulted me into an understanding of connection. And it was like a light switch.
I am connected to Sheffield because I studied in Sheffield. I so remember the way in which the parks are interlaced with each other, and that it's possible to walk from the town centre out into the countryside to be guided by the river and through the parks, and to feel that connection that you did with that flower and that connection with yourself. Through that moment. For those listeners who don't know what the Weald is and or quite what the Downs is like, can you explain what the Weald is, where you spent some of your time?
So in Sussex, we've got three highly designated landscapes. And one is Chichester Harbour, Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty. One is the South Downs National Park. And one is the High Weald, Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty. So they're landscapes protected for particular qualities and features. And the Weald is full of character in terms of its medieval field patterns, its woodlands. It's a very different feel to the Downs. So yes, as I say, much more wooded, lots of the sort of drove roads and the sort of ancient trackways. A very different quality and atmosphere. It's really beautiful and very different to the open downs, the chalk downs.
But not that you grew up with. So although you were brought up in Lewes, you mentioned that you didn't really know nature through your upbringing. What was it like being brought up in Lewes but not knowing nature?
So I have a few scattered memories of a walk on the downs or playing on the Lewes railway land, which was much bigger and had allotments back then. And the Grange Gardens in Lewes. Later on, I got the diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is effectively a trauma about disconnection. It's a mental health diagnosis. As a child, I didn't connect to nature. I didn't connect to the world. I lacked connection, and that's what trauma does. So over time and over lots of different experiences and work and self sort of care and therapy, one gets more and more connected. Trauma is defined by either numbness, lack, disassociation, or sort of high speed, high anxiety, high adrenaline. So there's two polarities. I sometimes get exasperated when people talk as if it's an assumption that everyone grew up with nature as a supportive factor and feature in their life. And one of the things that drives me as an individual in my work is to try and speak up and enable connection for people who won't have had it, who aren't ecologists, conservationists, who haven't experienced looking with their father for butterflies in the meadows when they grew up. They haven't had that. They don't have that nostalgia to look back on. So when we talk about trying to make a better world for the future, we cannot build that on nostalgia. We have to build that on a vision and a collaboration for a better world. We cannot assume that everyone has had abundance of nature in their life.
That's what I'm hearing loud and clear from you, Tor, that not everybody has had that experience of growing up with nature on their doorstep and or being taken into nature by family or friends, and that this is so important to be able to help people to connect with their own nature and the nature wherever they are. And that can be in a town, in a city, as well as in the countryside when we think about the future, or at the seaside.
Exactly. It all matters. It matters whether you feed the birds and watch the birds in your garden, whether you walk to the local park and what you notice about the trees, or whether you're really lucky enough to have walking boots and be able to go for long walks on the downs. You know, it all matters. Everyone's going to have a very different experience of connection to nature.
I love that moment where I spot something that has grown up between a crack in a pavement, despite the odds, you know, that it's been trodden on, and possibly the pavement has been swept and cleaned, and yet there will be something a little bit like the yellow flower that you spotted and that was your breakthrough moment. What did it open up for you, Tor?
I just want to reply to what you said, because the point about nature coming through the cracks is where it feels like a metaphor for rebellion and defiance. And you know, nature will live on. There's something really lovely in that. And I also appreciate the buddleia that grows on top of the railway line, or, you know, that just appears. So your question about how did that help form who I was?
Become as a leader, that moment where that yellow flower spoke to you and helped you to connect with yourself and what mattered to you after years of disconnection and having experienced trauma.
And I think it would be fair to say that people who have experienced trauma don't know that they're disconnected until they connect. So it was as if the world lit up in that moment. And I went out and soon after bought a book about wildflowers and became quite obsessed with the beauty of these tiny just tiny, beautiful plants and flowers around Sheffield and spent hours just looking at them as a sort of splendour, like in wonder, and probably did what one might do at five. I did it in my 20s with a book. So how it's helped shape me, it's partly this commitment to knowing that we all have different experiences and we cannot make assumptions on behalf of everybody about what their background or experience or motivation is. That if I'm in a group of conservationists or leaders for wildlife and people start making assumptions, I'm learning, I think in this conversation is really interesting, I'm learning all the time about what it is to be brave and say, actually, there are other things to be aware of. So thank you for this conversation. Yes, as I say, another way of enabling me to be brave about who I am.
And to speak up and to speak for, this is something I've been thinking about around being an ally, but also more than that, being an advocate and bringing that courage and curiosity. So asking questions where otherwise I might make assumptions. And I think that's what you're doing as a leader and a leader amongst leaders.
Yes. So I'm absolutely convinced that we cannot possibly speak up for nature and the environment if we can't speak up for ourselves. So my journey of being able to start to speak up for myself and say, whilst I might not be visibly different, I'm actually every day managing a difference, which can sometimes be really challenging. And so not to make assumptions about diversity and not to make assumptions about people. So the culture that I've really tried to enable at the Trust is that people must be able to speak up. And we've got lots of different mechanisms, I think, for doing that, where I encourage people to feel, if you like, as an equal. So we'll have a team meeting where everyone has 2 minutes, whether they're a director or whether they're a cleaner. Everybody is the same. Or whether we have good facilitation, which enables people to be really listened to and people not to interrupt them. So they get the space to be heard. I don't always get it right, of course, but I feel really strongly that if someone comes to me and says, I think this thing is wrong or difficult, that I'll give them space to express it and they won't be blamed or punished, as is so often in hierarchies. People don't want to hear things. And so people get blamed if they speak up. And in this area that we work in, speaking up for the environment, we can't have that kind of culture. We've got to be enabling the leaders of the future, people to feel able to speak up without backlash or without blame. It's been really interesting to watch Chris Packham recently and how much he's receiving kind of arson and hate mail, but he continues to speak up. You know, he continues and continues to speak up, and that defiance and belief, you know, it's extraordinary and really to be admired. Whether or not people agree with everything he says, it's an extraordinary capacity to keep going in the face of that backlash. But no one should have to have that.
Not unlike the flower breaking through the cracks in the pavement, in fact.
Indeed. I was aware of that as I was doing exactly the same thing. Thank you.
I've recently read a book called Belonging, and in which the definition of a belonging culture is one in which people feel safe enough to speak up. And I think more than ever, helping people to feel safe, to be able to give voice, as you say, whether we agree or disagree with them, but to be able to be heard, to be listened to have a voice, and for everyone to have a voice, is so important. And something that I'm really passionate about is creating that psychologically safe environment, a culture, supporting leaders like yourself to create that kind of environment, and a natural environment in which everybody can find their place. And I'm really fascinated by the three different places that you described for those people who are listening and may not know the Weald, the Downs and other parts of southern southeast England who live in different parts of the world, and how important place is to us, and also the challenge of displacement, of not belonging somewhere. I heard a quote a while ago, I'm not sure whose it is, where she asks, what's the opposite of fitting in? And you might think the answer is not fitting in, but it's not. The answer she gave was belonging. The opposite of fitting in is belonging. That sense of belonging here in this place. And I think that's so important. I think it might have been Brené Brown, but I'm not sure.
Yes, one seems effortless and one seems effortful.
Say more about that.
What I heard was belonging is effortless. It's something that happens as I walk or as I'm where I am or where I'm heard. And fitting in has been, it feels like a lot of the effort that I've made in my life to make myself, to shape myself so that other people, to other people's circumstances or expectations. So fitting in is with effort. I have to keep pretending that I'm not who I am to fit in. And belonging has a ease and a grace and a peace with it.
And it's energizing rather than tiring. I think it is exhausting trying to fit in or pretending to be someone else. So it's really great to hear the connection that you make between the importance of our being able to speak up for ourselves and to speak up for nature. There's something in speaking up for our own natures and speaking up for nature as part of that belonging in nature, I think.
Absolutely. And to have the space to speak up and get things wrong and speak up and learn how to form an opinion and be able to be. So I think there's probably work we need to do as a trust about supporting kids with leadership skills, about speaking up and about facilitating. And we need to have a whole new generation of people coming through that aren't going to reenact the Hanford Parish Council debacle, where you have these meetings that are so full of challenge and ego that they don't function. And so many partnerships and groupings that take years to make anything real happen because they're sort of stuck in a slightly traumatized institutional stuckness. And how we enable people to, for the future, speak up really effectively and work together effectively and challenge effectively, feel brave enough and confident and feel really committed and clear to their own principles and their own vision, that they can speak up. I think it's imperative.
And that they have people like you to encourage finding that voice. There's a lovely quote from Vanessa Redgrave. She gave this at the end of an acceptance speech in which she said, find your truth and your voice will follow. And helping young people, helping people to find their truth, to find who they are and why they're here and the principles that guide them alongside everybody else, I think, is what you're talking about. What are the principles that you live and lead by, Tor?
One I've had for years and years, which is I really feel very strongly that the further up the hierarchy somebody goes, the more commitment they have to self-awareness of the shadow and the impact they can have on others. It seems to be, you know, it should be mandatory in a job description. If you get a career advancement, if you go up the ladder, that you need to have more self-awareness because you have more and more potential to ruin someone's day the higher up the hierarchy you go because of the nature of power. And when you hold power, I know I can ruin someone's day just because of the position I hold. So I feel really strongly we have to be aware of, and I know we're all going to have blind spots and we're not going to get things right all the time, but to be conscious of how we might impact on others and to be able to collaborate and be really careful with our own egos, not to let them get in the way too much.
I agree with you. And I think one of the questions I often ask leaders like yourself is, what's the impact you want to have? So not just being aware of the shadow you might cast, but also what is the light you want to shine? How do you want people to feel around you? And for a long time now, I've wanted leaders to know how I want them to feel around me, which is to feel seen, heard, and understood. And of course, that goes back to my childhood of having spent some years not feeling seen, heard, and understood. And I may have been, but I didn't always feel it. I didn't really feel seen, heard, and certainly not understood. I frequently felt misunderstood. So the impact that I want to have, it's an aspiration. I don't always have that impact, but I aspire to have that impact. And I wonder, what is your aspiration?
So I feel very strongly that given that we have a hierarchy system rather than a flat structure, if you like, given that that's the starting point for you talking me in this leadership position, within a hierarchy, my belief is that there should be very clear boundaries that you create with people. So you're co-creating the boundaries, whether they be policies or whether they be mechanisms for agreeing projects. You're co-creating them together, and people then know where the edges are. So then they're safe enough then to be creative and flourish within that. Because often the most challenging situations we have is where people are so creative and boundaryless that they create havoc, or whether they're so extraordinarily boundaried that they upset people with the kind of detail. So there's a kind of balance in the middle where people are really supported to be themselves. They know where they stand. And I've had a lot of feedback about people being relieved about having systems and boundaries in place to enable them, because it then they know where they are, and then they can do their jobs really well. I've done recently a leadership course which was about trauma. And so it was about what trauma organisations carry in and of themselves, and what traumatic situations might have happened in an organisation's history that haven't been fully integrated, or what processes might have been set up because of trauma, but so are historic and not necessary anymore. But one of the things that was fascinating about that was the notion that an organisation is an embodied impulse. Say that again, because I love it. Yes. An organisation is an embodied impulse, and that could be 3 people, it could be 10,000 people, but it's a impulse of direction. And so my job is to ensure that that embodied impulse has the best possible chance of fulfilling its purpose, if you like. And it's like an organism in and of itself, isn't it? Because it's people. The organisation is made up of individuals. And we've got so many passionate people who feel really strongly and sometimes argue a lot, because there are different polarities within the environmental sector of beliefs. But this notion that we're an impulse has really helped me think about the organisation and its and how it flows and how it gets stuck and then how it flows again. And just it's really, really interesting. And what areas in the organisation might be a bit flat or a bit have lacking in energy, and where might there be too much energy, and where might there be the repeat conflicts or repeat difficulties that go on, where you know there's a stuckness in the system that needs to be freed up. So just noticing, taking the time to notice the organism of the organisation, I feel is in.
I'd love to know and to hear more about that, not least because of the experience that we've all had of the pandemic, and that therefore every leader worldwide and all people everywhere are experiencing a collective trauma. And I wonder what insights from your recent leadership course you might have for leaders listening to this conversation that they might be able to apply to their organization, where people are living through this trauma that we're all going through.
So one of the practices as an individual, one of the main learnings is that if you react to a situation, you're bringing your own history, but if you respond, you're in the present. Because a responsive leader is someone who's really listening to what's happening in the now. But a reactive leader is likely to bringing their own baggage or backlog, why they're getting upset or frustrated at that particular scenario. So that's something about the individual. I think one of the other interesting things was about the context that you've got individuals with their own trauma, and that might be current or past, because they might have bereavements, they might have personal histories that they're bringing, personal circumstances. You've then also got generational trauma. So some families come from, if you have families that have got difficult migration or Holocaust or racism in their slavery in their background, they're bringing that ancestral generational trauma. And then you've got these kind of global traumas that add into that mix.
Yes.
So part of the learning was really about this, how a lot of the systems that we've got in our culture now are born out of some of the traumas that have been created after the war. And so there's something about not always taking it for granted that the systems are the right systems or the ways that we engage are the right ones. If they're not really enabling, because I think it should feel good, shouldn't it? Work, you should have a flow. Work is hard, that's its nature, but there should be a flow in a good direction. And if you haven't got that flow, if you keep getting stuck, notice that. Notice how much stuckness there is in the system. Really give that attention. Because, yes, we need to enable flow. That's the point of it, isn't it, really? We've brought a future direction rather than a stuckness from the past.
That's great guidance, I think, to leaders to take some time to notice where the flow may be blocked or stuck, and rather than reacting to it, to respond to it, to notice it, to respond to it, and combine that with having created a psychologically safe environment in which people can then speak to it, then there's a conversation, isn't there, to be had that will help unblock that stuckness, unstick the blockage.
Yes, and we all have the experience of being in a meeting where you come out and feel energized, and being in a meeting and coming out where you feel really your shoulders are sagging and you're just frustrated. And so noticing if you've got meetings which repeat, which are ones that are great, what is it about them that makes it great? And the ones that keep having a stuckness, the situations that just notice and just keep kind of giving attention to unlocking some of that.
And what you can learn from those meetings where you yourself may have had the impact on others of having them feel energized, where others have had the impact upon you of having you feel energized. What is it about those meetings, and how could you take that experience into those other meetings, learn from that experience? It's that self-awareness, I think, you're talking about, Tor. How can you take that as a leader into other meetings and re-energize them, help people to find their energy and have them leave that meeting feeling energized and ready for the next thing? Because as you say, work is hard, but needing to have fun and to flow with each other, a little bit like that river running through Sheffield and through the parks that takes you on, and that we need to make time to stop to notice, as you did the yellow flower. You stopped to notice. And if we're rushing or if we're stuck, we're less likely to notice and be open to noticing how people really are and what's really going on.
And I would add to that, as we've said about every aspect of enabling nature matters, or noticing nature matters, also every individual can make a contribution which matters. So a healthy organisation will flourish if each individual feels that their contribution matters, and their, whatever it is, whatever area they're working in, that they feel that it matters and they're adding to something.
And knowing what they're adding to as well,
yeah.
I think, Tor, you were talking about the impulse direction, the future, the vision, and that everybody is part of making that happen. Everybody has a contribution, that they matter, that you matter, that they matter as part of making that happen. We're coming up to COP26. This conversation, our conversation today, will probably be published soon after COP26. What are your hopes for the future for COP26, Tor?
Well, given what we've been discussing now, I mean, my real hope is that there is some really real effective leadership and conversations which enable things to become unstuck. You know, that's got to be the heart of it, hasn't it? It's about this is about people making agreements for a better future. So my hope is that people will put down some of the reactiveness or the difficulty and reach some agreements and really lead. Mm. That's the job, isn't it? Really lead so that we're on track. We're on track to meet targets, that we're really putting legislation in place to make it happen, that we're funding that, that we're committed, that we've got our leaders are demonstrating from the top that they're going to lead the way on this. And I think a lot of people have got expectations for that. And we can't have a situation where people feel incredibly deflated afterwards, no matter where we go. We've got to have a situation where people feel they've come out with some real prizes, that we've got people being authentic and making really good decisions for the future. That will give young people confidence, and all of us, as I said, you know, about the sort of boundaries and the framework and the leadership to make this happen.
I was just thinking that the boundaries you spoke about, it's about re-boundarying, isn't it? And making commitments to boundaries and to agreements and honouring those commitments, honouring each mm-hmm. other, and knowing that only through working together can we make this work, and that will give hope, and that we all have a part to play in that, and especially leaders in leading the way and demonstrating that commitment.
Mm.
Sussex Wildlife Trust is part of the Wildlife Trust group. How does that work, Tor? You're a leader amongst leaders. Other parts of the UK have their own wildlife trust that people can join and can be helped to make a contribution in their own area.
I find this such a fascinating model. So the National Trust or the RSPB or the Woodland Trust are obviously national voluntary organisations working for the environment. And the Wildlife Trust has a national organisation and 46 local wildlife trusts, each its own charity with its own, you know, governing body. At its best, it works brilliantly as a kind of collaboration and, you know, sort of real excitement. And really, you know, somebody, one CEO is leading on badgers and somebody else is leading on climate change and somebody else is leading on nature-based solutions. There's all sorts of different energies going on and different leaders. And then sometimes, obviously, it can be challenging if there's a disagreement. But I think we've got better and better at enabling those difficult conversations, so we're all going together in the same direction. But yeah, what a tremendous force for good. What we have is, it's really like a value-based membership. So the membership, which is now over 38,000, which we're really super proud of, and we came out of the pandemic with more members, which was quite unheard of in the you know, in the charitable sector. And we did a lot of work to support and keep hold of our members during that time. People join us because of the value base, that we're here to lead for Sussex, to speak up for Sussex, that we're going to then be really sensitive to the place, Sussex itself. We've got experts who know about different towns or areas of Sussex or marine. We've got that local expertise. And yeah, I think we've got a really loyal following. We're 60 years old this year. So
congratulations.
We're celebrating. And we've opened a visitor centre at Rye Harbour Nature Reserve to enable people to really learn about what a special place this is and take responsibility as stewards going forward for it. I would say it's a really interesting movement, the Wildlife Trust movement. And it's a real privilege to be part of it. And I do, we have very good relationships with our neighbours in Kent and Hampshire and Surrey.
There's a real sense of you working together, of the trusts, you know, which are themselves boundaried, aren't they, by the different counties, the different areas, but that you come together and share your passions and at best are energised by each other, give each other hope and aspiration. So a sort of microcosm almost of what you're hoping for, and we're hoping for COP26 as well, that those conversations will happen, that the commitments will be made.
Yes, and for COP26, I think I just see there's such a movement, isn't there, community, and a sort of energised movement to push for real change at that, which is fantastic to see. All sorts of different talks and kind of demonstrations and challenges and letter writing and, you know, all sorts of energy being put into that from across the country.
And across the world. At Sussex Wildlife Trust, you talk about nature recovery. And for anybody listening to our conversation, they may be really encouraged to find out more, but would like to know what you mean by nature recovery.
So nature recovery, the starting point for this is that it's generally agreed that more than half of the UK species of wildlife are in decline. And we've lost a lot of our habitats, and a lot of places are now very fragmented and cut off, so wildlife can't move about so freely. There aren't the corridors that there might have been. There's more pollution. There's been some quite challenging agricultural practices over the years. There's significantly more development, more fishing, more trawling. There's been water shortages. There's pollution. So there's been a whole range of impacts on nature over the years. And the nature recovery is that we're anticipating legislation at the end of this year which would put some boundaries and some clarity and some targets and some binding targets in place for ensuring that nature does have a chance of recovering. And so this is legislation that the environmental movement has been hoping for a long time. So again, this, it could be quite an interesting autumn, this, with COP26. And the legislation, if it all both goes to plan, we could come into next year and see some really good foundations for enabling nature to make a recovery.
It's interesting where we started our conversation, and you were talking about trauma and trauma recovery through nature, that in fact nature recovery is not dissimilar, that nature is recovering from traumas, some of them unwitting and some of them witting, by way of what has happened and the decline that perhaps wasn't perceptible at first and then is now so very noticeable, and we're all more aware of how important it is to reconnect, to recover, to make some changes for the future. As we come to the end of our conversation, Tor, what three things in particular would you encourage leaders to pay attention to, who themselves may not be in the wildlife movement or even focused in their organisation on nature, but for all of us, sustainability and thinking about the ecological impact of what we do is more important than ever. What three things would you encourage leaders to pay attention to, both in their organisation, with their people, and in the environment?
Well, one would be that there are a lot of people at different levels who are really committed and excited and have a lot of energy for positive change. So these kind of cross-organisational teams we can set up that then enable people, staff, to have a voice and actually help make the change, I think is really fundamental. I think you obviously need expert insight and a plan. But I think also there's something really fundamental now about this is now part and part of being a leader. This is non-negotiable now. It is not something that's the bottom of a list or something we can do next year or it's a tick box. It's non-negotiable. in terms of leadership of organisations, that decisions about the environment, decisions that take the environment into account are made. It's absolutely critical. This is a new time we're in. It needs that level of commitment to it.
It's an imperative, isn't it? Thank you, Tor. Thank you very much for your wisdom, for your insight, and for all your thinking about leadership and what leadership means now and how important it is to be a leader and to be thinking about these things now and for the future, for talking about them and for making a difference. Thank you, Tor. To find out more about Sussex Wildlife Trust, do go to their website, sussexwildlifetrust.org.uk. To find out more about the Wildlife Trust, go to wildlifetrust.org. And if you're in the UK, you'll be able to find your local Wildlife Trust and discover how you can get involved in nature recovery and in your local Wildlife Trust. To listen to other leaders in conversation, do go to my website, annietownen.com. And if you would like to be a leader in conversation, please get in touch with me via my email, annie@annietownen.com. I look forward to hearing from you.